Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, librarians at the State Library are documenting Southern Arizona's Jewish history. And a new exhibition at the Heard Museum showcases Native American art on an unusual canvas. But first, it is our Friday newscap and a look ahead at some of the biggest issues facing Arizona politics in the new year.
We're expecting a ramping up of federal enforcement and potentially a good amount of collaboration at the state level in that larger mass deportation operation.
The voters have sent a crystal clear message that this ban that is currently in place in Arizona has no place in our state.
We anticipate that there will be those who oppose the will of the voters and still would like to restrict people's ability to access abortion care, but we're prepared to meet them, whoever they may be.
Obviously, it's going to be different. The majority controls the legislation that goes to the floor. But my experience over this 4 years is working together with Republicans.
This morning, I am joined by two longtime political strategists here in Arizona, Stacey Pearson with Lumen Strategies. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Chuck Coughlin, president and CEO of GOP consulting firm High Ground.
Happy to be here.
All right. So this morning, we're going to do things a little differently on the newscap because it's the beginning of a new year. We have a new administration coming in, a very different one, in fact. So we're going to talk about what might be to come on the political horizon in Arizona in 2025 and how some of these big national issues will likely hit home this year. I want to start with immigration, obviously a big one on the national front, obviously a big one here in Arizona. We have a promise from the incoming Trump administration of mass deportations to come. We're not sure what this might look like at this point, but the idea of roundups, of deportations, of maybe workplace raids has a long and kind of storied history in Arizona, which I know you both have been witness to.
Right.
Stacey, let's start with you. What are you expecting to come on this front?
So I think we will see lots of publicity stunts and very little movement in actually removing folks from the country. I think that Homeland Security agents, even local law enforcement trying to comply with the proposition that passed in November, will be finding folks that are high profile, people that have committed other crimes, be it DUIs, burglaries, things that will be covered in a way that make it look more impactful than it really is.
So, Chuck, do you think this will look more like that, or do you think it'll look more like what we saw under former Sheriff Joe Arpaio?
Well, I think he'll start cleaning out the jails of anybody with any type of non-immigration violation that is not here legally.
We have Jerry Sheridan coming in as sheriff.
Right, and I think that's what's going to happen. I think he's going to do that as a first step. But I'm not so sure that it's going to be that's going to be the end of it. I think we will see some industry-based workplace raids based on belief of illegal employment. And I think he's going to have to do that to fulfill his promise to the constituencies which represented him and create some kind of momentum underneath some type of immigration reform. That's where I'm most intrigued by, is to see what he says in his State of the Union speech and what he commits to in terms of building hopefully something similar to the bipartisan package that he torpedoed, he could say, now this is mine and this is the right thing to do. Because I think we all know if something like that happened, that'd be good for Arizona. That would be a good step forward. But we'll see. We'll all wait, hold our breath and see how disaster. But we've all lived through this, like you said before, Arpaio and that scenarios of the workplace roundups and the immigration sweeps and those types of things.
Right. So we have lived through this before in Arizona, and we've seen some significant backlash to that here in our state. Stacey, do you anticipate that if what Chuck says starts to happen, are you going to see people change their tune on immigration?
When we don't have a labor force, like what happened in 2000, what year was that? 10-ish, let's say, with 1070. When we don't have a workforce that will pick lettuce or pick watermelons and our produce starts to shoot through the roof, the business community, the folks worried about the economy are going to start squawking. And it's awful, but it really, people start to respond when it impacts them personally, when their landscaper left the state or their childcare provider took off. I mean, it really has to impact people personally. The unfortunate part is if history repeats itself, what we will see is a reduction in crime. And it has nothing to do with crime not being committed. It has everything to do with people being afraid to call 911. And so the actual call volume is going to go down and the Republicans are going to take credit for it. But it doesn't mean our community is any safer.
There's a history of this, as we said, in Arizona. I wanted to ask you about 1070, Chuck, because you were kind of in the governor's office when this all happened, right? 15 years ago, almost.
Such a lovely memory. Thank you so much. Trip down memory lane here.
But at the time, like, it was a popular measure.
Hugely popular.
But then it wasn't, right? We saw this massive backlash. Yep. What would too far look like, Chuck?
Well, I think if we get into some of these workplace raids, that would affect some of the unions. I think Stacey's right on the employment side. That's going to start impacting because we all know there's not enough people here to do all the jobs. And so if he goes after hotel workers, maids, those types of things that are traditionally represented by labor.
Caregivers.
Caregivers. If you get into that space, you will get an organized response to that. You will get an organized labor response to that. Because that's essentially what created the noise around 1070, was organized labor bringing in opposition and speaking to that and displacement and civil rights and those types of things that came up. So I would, if he tips the scale that way and starts a sweep of industries and businesses, you will see that happen.
That's interesting because you're both talking about it in terms of the economy, essentially.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you about that in terms of Prop 314. We just saw a very similar measure passed very heartily by Arizona voters, but not much opposition at all from the Latino community, from the business community, sort of trepidation maybe, but not a lot of any kind of organized response. Where will that come from? Or does it not happen this time, Stacey?
So I think it will come from the ground up. To Chuck's point, the labor groups that are representing construction worker, tradesmen, building trades, those folks. And then it's going to really get personal for people that their kid's best friend in fifth grade is not in class anymore. And the woman that's been helping take care of grandma is not here anymore. And I think those responses are going to be pretty intense. And when we're seeing folks that get deported and have to leave behind their American children, and we see DCS enrollment swell, children in custody of the state, it really is going to get ugly.
Yeah, the family separation thing is going to be huge. If that becomes an issue, I mean, we're all reading about that right now, right? We're reading about parents who are here without authorization
and have had
kids in the United States who are American citizens. And when that starts tripping that wire, you get back into that childhood separation issue, the family separation issue, that's going to be a problem. I mean, he's got to know that, though. He's got to understand that. And so how much saber rattling, I mean, that's the way I look at a lot of his stuff, is how much saber rattling is going to go on here and noise making and posturing and message sending and then what really happens. That's why I'm interested to see congressionally if he prioritizes, as they should, they should prioritize a border security measure and a modernization of the Customs and Border Patrol to give them more resources and be able to let people adjudicate or process them through a system. That doesn't happen right now. We don't have the courts. We don't have those institutions available, and he can make that happen.
Stacey, do you think there's any shot of comprehensive immigration reform of any kind, even a conservative version, happening in this Congress?
Oh, gosh, I would hope so. I mean, it is so long overdue.
And we're both highly cynical.
Yeah, we're starting out the new year so optimistic. But, I certainly hope so. And we've kicked the can on immigration in a way that has now cost the Democrats significantly. I mean, we have not given Dreamer Kids status.
Right.
And we wonder, everybody wrang their hands in, you know, and clutched pearls in November. What happened with Latinos? Well, we've made broken promises to mixed status families now for decades. And so if the Republicans are smart, they will process comprehensive immigration reform and do what Reagan did and win over a generation
and of Latinos. The other trigger here that could be going on is the SB 4 litigation, which I'm not familiar with. I don't know where that's at.
Happening out of Texas, though,
Right, but that appeal process and that will go on. He'll use that. He'll use that as a backstop to talk about what is the problem and how we need to let states enforce it, because he's not, he's a federalist in a way. He wants, you know, abortion policy now done by the states. He will want this to have statewide federalist enforcement. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that, because he'll use that in the course of this narrative.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to go to a quick break. Stacey Pearson, Chuck Coughlin, thank you so much. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. All right, and we're back with more of our Friday newscap. We are joined by Stacey Pearson with Lumen Strategies, Chuck Coughlin, president and CEO of GOP consulting firm High Ground, joining us both this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to move on to abortion, another big national issue. We can expect to have a big impact here in Arizona and really across the country heading into this year. Arizona had a roller coaster of a year when it came to abortion. Let's not forget last year, 2024, now last year, from the state Supreme Court upholding the territorial area near total abortion ban to the state legislature actually doing something bipartisan and coming together to repeal it. Now, of course, we have a pretty overwhelming win for abortion rights advocates in the state with the passage of Prop 139. Stacey, let me start with you here. The passage of that proposition didn't really end the story, we should say, of what happens next with abortion law in Arizona. It goes to the courts, essentially.
Exactly. The mandate was given to the state legislature and to the courts now to clean up some of these outdated laws. Women in Arizona today are still required to have an unnecessary ultrasound, vaginal ultrasound, before they get a prescription medication. So that is beyond insanity. Oh, and a woman is also required to get the permission of her husband to end a pregnancy. And so some of these laws that remain on the books need to get cleaned up.
24-hour waiting period.
24-hour waiting period.
Right. We're already seeing the governor act on some of these at the end of the year here, saying some of these requirements that that providers report to the state have to be changed. Chuck, this was an issue that Democrats really banked on winning in 2024, maybe even for the presidency, and it didn't really pan out. I won't ask you why that is, because I think there's been a lot of talk about that. But I wonder, heading into 2025, do you think that abortion is kind of defanged as a political issue for the left?
I think most of the public is convinced that it is now a constitutional right for a female to have an abortion in Arizona. Mm. And I think that is what's in people's minds. All of these requirements, well-stated objections from the community on that are still there, and I get it. I just don't think it's headline material. It's not the kind of stuff that people, well, you're still getting your abortion, right? And, you know, it's like, well, shouldn't you think about, I mean, you can hear this conversation at the legislature. Mm-hmm. And I just don't see a lot of bipartisan appeal to go do much about that. I understand the politics of it. The governor is well positioned to make those points with the minority caucus. Mm-hmm. But I'm not seeing that there'll be a lot of sympathy on the other side to continue the ball rolling. You know, if they were in the legislature, you know, this would be another issue you'd put on the ballot, right? And maybe that's something that the legislature will consider doing, putting something on the ballot that addresses all of these preconditions.
Chuck, do you think there's any chance that at the federal level, we will see any action on this from the Trump administration, any kind of coalescing by Republicans who now have, you know, majorities everywhere to restrict abortion in any way?
There will certainly be efforts on the Republican side to limit that, to create some kind of national restriction. I don't think it will be reflective of a majority of the Republicans in both the House and the Senate. But you'll hear about it. And I'm sure the abortion rights proponents will make a lot of noise about that. I don't think Trump wants anything to do with it. I don't think a thoughtful senator wants anything to do with it. And I think that they'll you know, they'll follow the line. It's up to the states. Let the states decide this.
What does that mean, Chuck, for the future of the GOP, which has for so long been a pro-life party, right?
Like, I mean, a cocktail. because you could say that about both parties.
Yes.
I mean, you could
and
say
I'll
that.
And I'll ask Stacey next, yes.
Yeah, you could say that about both parties. I don't know what you know, you can see the format of the Republican Party here. It's now representing angry Americans, people who are alienated from the government, people who feel like the government's not working for them, people who, you know, you go through TSA and you get treated like a piece of baggage, you know, or, you know, you're asking your banker for some information and they give you an 800 number to call. You know, it's that kind of, I go back to this idea of the customer's always right. That's not true anymore. You go to the back of the line in big business today. And I think there's a Republican issue there that they will use in a deregulatory environment, talking about deregulation, talking about putting people back in charge. But I don't know. I really don't know, because the party is so fragmented on some of these right-wing issues that there's clearly not a plurality of Americans that agree with them on that, maybe Republicans, or what is called Republican today. But it's not a broad cross-section of the country.
Yeah.
So somebody needs to come up with a narrative. I mean, both David Brooks said this in a column a while ago. He said both parties are acting like minority parties, like they're trying to unseat the other party. And somebody has to start to act like a majority party and give the country a governing narrative. Because we don't have that right now.
That's a really interesting way to put it. So the abortion question and the future of the Democrats to you, Stacey. And then I want to talk more broadly about that idea. Go ahead.
I think we are going to see Democrats hold up the filibuster and celebrate the filibuster, which is
crazy,
incredibly ironic, right? And former Senator Sinema has had a few choice tweets about this. But it's I think the filibuster will prevent any national legislation from being enacted. And would you look at that?
The Sinema, we should say, made a big point about keeping the filibuster.
Nostradamus,
yes.
As it were.
Yeah, it's weird how that works. It's almost like she was really smart and knew things. It's, look at that.
So this brings me to some broader questions I wanted to ask about the future, in particular of the Democratic Party heading into 2025 after these big losses in 2024. Let's talk about that narrative question that you brought up, Chuck. Like this idea that the Democratic Party in particular, but maybe both parties, right, need to come up with a narrative for the country, with this very divided and fractured country going forward. Start there, Stacey. What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree with Chuck that is very much the issue. And when you look at the autopsy of the November 24 election in Maricopa County alone, Maricopa County lost 72,000 Democrats, just a net loss in registration. Harris lost Maricopa County by 71,000 votes. 72 came off the books. She lost by 71.
Wow.
We have to figure out what that is. And in precincts that where Trump flipped, and in this area that everyone talks about, the Latino turnout for Trump, and it's the machismo, I think we're getting too far into the weeds on identity politics. The two sections of the city that Trump gained the most ground have the crappiest traffic. It's the folks who were just fighting in rush hour. Well, maybe not now because we're close to holidays, but it was the northeast section of the 101. Hmm. So essentially the 101 from Shea-ish up to the 51. And then I-10 West, which is a certifiable parking lot.
Traffic jam.
Hmm. Yeah. So
Both ways.
Those are the precincts that government in its most basic form, to Chuck's point a second ago,
Service
isn't
people.
Working.
Right.
It's not working for them. They're trying to get their mom's Social Security benefits sorted out. They're on hold for 6 hours before it turns 5 o'clock on the East Coast. They get hung up on.
Yep.
Yes, that literally happened to me. You know, it's the freeways aren't working. The schools are bad. They can't get their kids caught up. They're spending too much on after school care. It's just this collapse of anything that they need.
Yeah, there's no general identity there of a constituency that they're talking to. Stacey mentioned the identity stuff, which has sort of captured the narrative of that party for too long, and it needs to be redefined. It used to be the working class, you know, the working class guy. Guess what? Trump now owns that.
Yep.
And so, you know, okay, who are we? What are we doing? Because you're losing the registration battle. There's no horizon that I see that in my lifetime in the next 10 years that says, oh, Democrats are going to start registering more and more voters. They're in this perpetual minority party status Republicans can still do it because they're breeding that anger and that discontent and that alienation that people feel from government. They're embodying that right now. And so what do? So I'm going to pay you both for therapy here. It'll be my therapy session. So my idea there was Prop 140 was open up the party to allow it to include larger constituencies.
Right.
Begin the Democratic Party, in my mind, should begin to narrate to that constituency and invite them into their narrative, which starts with equality.
Equality. Stacey, what do you think for the Democrats going forward? What would you do if you were the one deciding what narrative they should pick?
Oh, we just need to get away from this cast of consultants who studied poverty. It's my favorite insult to people. I literally love it. It's the meanest thing I say to someone who's lecturing me about things we should be doing. I ask them, did you study poverty? Because if you were poor, you know what an obnoxious question that is. And the number of people who say, well, yes, when I got my master's at Georgetown, I'm like, you have no idea what you're talking about. And so it's to just get out of this. We need to get off this high horse where we've got the answers to people's problems we don't even understand. So I think just getting back to basics and talking about the kitchen table issues for people and get rid of some of the consultants that studied poverty.
I agree. I mean, look at what Arizona has done well historically. Mm. We've invested in infrastructure well, including educational infrastructure. Yep. We have some of the most robust community college systems here in the state, which are an amazing opportunity for workforce training, to give people an opportunity to improve their lives. That's a great opportunity to talk about that and talk about how we're creating greater opportunities. I mean, look at all the job opportunities that are being created right now in Arizona.
Yep.
As a result of where we are and who we are. Our economy is always going to be growing. It's like the one thing most Arizona governors are blessed with the exception of a few, are like, holy Christ, I got the whole economic boom going on behind me.
Yeah.
I should be able to manage this and do well with this. So think about what we do well. Think about what we've historically done well. The governor's doing some of that right now, talking about water policy and trying to create more of an opportunity for, again, treat everybody equally.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some infrastructure issues there that government's generally good with, that people look to government to provide those kind of answers.
Okay. Final question for you both, and a little bit of a game, right? Two questions here. If you could sum up 2024 in one word, right, in Arizona politics, what would it be?
In one word.
Chaos.
Not a bad one.
I would go chaos.
Okay.
Back to your abortion thing earlier, that was chaotic the whole time. Back to Trump's run, the Biden-Harris evolution. It was literally chaos. It was just crazy.
Stacey?
See, one word is so hard. Because I want to say dumpster fire, but that's a lot
that's
like
close.
Chaos.
I'll take it.
It's a little too chaos. No, I think it was defining. How about that?
Sure.
I mean, we have learned a lot, hopefully a lot of really, we as Democrats, really important lessons about the way we're talking to people or down to people or at people, the way we've defined people. We miss the mark on a lot of really, really important approaches.
Yeah. Okay, so one word for what you're predicting, maybe hoping, maybe for 2025.
Oh, wow. So we have to put on our optimistic hat here.
You don't have to. It could be a bad one.
Yeah, I know, but come on. We got the whole year ahead of us.
It's a new year.
I don't want to start in where I am right now, for God's sake. I don't want to start where I am right now. So I'm gonna say hopeful. I'm going to say hopeful that Trump can get some things done, that this Doge thing can actually maybe be somewhat effective. I'm going to hope for some immigration type stuff. I'm going to hope that the Middle East gets less conflicted as a result of this. I'm going to hope that we find a solution in Ukraine that is acceptable to the Ukrainian people, that we reduce conflict around the world. That would all be good things.
Stacey?
I would say connected. I think we are evolving away from just folks sitting in front of their cable news televisions and watching what the pundits are giving them.
Streaming,
mm-hmm. right? People are more connected. They're seeing different content. I think we're getting folks a little bit out of the bubble. That's what I'm most hopeful for.
Man, but what is that new bubble? That's pretty crazy.
That's right. I guess it's the devil we know.
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely more democratized media sources.
All right. Well, I appreciate your efforts there on those one words. Those are not easy. All right. Stacey Pearson with Lubin Strategies. Chuck Coughlin, president and CEO of GOP consulting firm High Ground. Thank you both so much.
Thank you,
Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how shoes are breaking the mold of Native American art. But first, lots of people traveled to Arizona during its early days as a territory and later as a state. Those people came from many places and were of many backgrounds. And librarians at the Arizona State Library have been looking into Jewish history, specifically in southern Arizona. Yom Levin is the Arizona Collection and Reading Arizona Librarian at the State of Arizona Research Library. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about this, starting with how robust a history of Jewish people there is in that part of the state.
I think there's a lot that still needs to be uncovered. There's a few really wonderful books about Arizona history, and they really try to break it down by different cities. I mean, Phoenix gets a lot of attention, but I think we have to remember that throughout Arizona's history, when it was a territory, and even when it was part of New Mexico territory, there were so many opportunities to start a new city, to start a new business. If you just had a little bit of capital, or you knew some people, or you had a friend or a cousin. So I think it's a lot more extensive than many of us realize.
So you kind of alluded to this, but I wanted to ask you more specifically, like for the people who came, especially, you know, sort of in the early days of Tucson and Pima County in southern Arizona, did Jewish people who came come for the same reasons as other people in terms of maybe looking for a fresh start or a new opportunity or just to get away to someplace new?
Absolutely. You know, I think if we think about Jewish American history very, very, very broadly, we have a few images in our mind. We think of maybe people know about the massive immigration of Sephardic Jews very early in the United States history. And then there was the really big wave of Eastern European Jews mm-hmm. when a lot of Europeans were coming to the U.S. But not everybody wants to live in New York City, you know, or North Carolina. And so people just moved west, just like everybody else, to have a homestead or to start a business or have a family. Or sometimes people kind of wanted to get away from bigger Jewish communities and be maybe a little more secular or start a different branch of Judaism, because Judaism, there's a lot of branches, or a different like sect. So it's pretty much, it's like everybody else, really, you know, just a new fresh start and opportunities.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting because I think, you know, for a lot of people, myself included, you know, you think about, for example, that big wave of immigration in the early part of the 20th century, and you immediately think of, for example, like the Lower East Side of Manhattan with lots mm-hmm. of delis and tenements. And you don't think, for example, of places like Tucson or even places like Arizona. But as you're saying, there were lots of people that were coming west for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, you know, and I think maybe for some people it might have been political too. You know, maybe they didn't want to live in more liberal areas because Arizona has a history of more conservative leaning Jewish people. And I think that's true to today also. Yeah, and I think it's a slightly different culture because a lot of people really tried to integrate themselves into what was happening wherever they were settling. So a really good example of that is Harry Drachman. He was, the Drachman family was really prominent, and they had stores and a cigar shop and a shoe store, and they were philanthropists, and they did a lot for building Tucson as a city. And he was an active member of the Order of Knights of Pythias, and he ran for Pima County Supervisor, and he was a Democrat in 1902, which is not the same Democratic Party that we think of today, right?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the people who moved west, especially to Arizona, were kind of on a different path than, let's say, the folks who ran the very delicious delis of New York City.
For those Jewish people who traveled west and ended up in southern Arizona, what kind of reception did they get when they got there?
From what I saw and what I read, it seems to be a really positive reception. Another example is in Graham County, the town of Solomon used to be the county seat, and it was actually started by I.E. Solomon and his wife, Anna. And when he moved there, he had a store, and then he had a bank, and he really built up Solomon, back then Solomonville, to a very prominent town, to the point where it became the county seat. And there was an article in a newspaper, and somebody commented something like, oh, there are Jewish people here, this is a good place to move to for new opportunities. Which is really nice to see, considering the history of anti-Semitism, right? Like that, I think for the most part, people were really accepting of Jewish people in Arizona, at least territorial Arizona, from what I've read.
Sure. So when you look at southern Arizona now, can you still see elements and evidence of some of these early Jewish settlers in that area?
Oh, sure. So, well, first off, there's the Tucson Jewish Museum and Holocaust Center, which is wonderful, and they do all kinds of programming. But there's also the buildings that have been left over that have, maybe some of them have been repurposed, but some of them are still around in Tucson, like Steinfeld's building. It was repurposed. I forget what it was repurposed into, but the building itself is still there. And so people who are longtime Tucson residents, they might remember the Steinfeld's building.
All right. That is Yom Levin, Arizona Collection and Reading Arizona Librarian with the State of Arizona Research Library. Yom, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for hosting me. It's been wonderful.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. A new exhibition at the Heard Museum of Native American Art combines fine art and footwear. The show's Sam Dingman has the story.
About 20 years ago, on a dare, Charles King hot glued some coins to a pair of sneakers. King owns a couple of galleries, one in Santa Fe and another in Scottsdale. He specializes in Pueblo pottery. One day, one of the artists whose work he shows, Susan Falwell, got this idea. Instead of painting a pot, she wanted to decorate shoes. Falwell told King, let's both do it. I'll do a pair, you do a pair. So she painted a winged turquoise lizard with futuristic goggles on the heel of a pair of Chuck Taylor All-Stars, and King got out his hot glue gun. When they finished, King realized they might be onto something. He started reaching out to other potters he knew, and before long, he found himself with a unique collection. Dozens of Chucks, size 10 and a half, decorated with original designs by some of the most famous ceramic artists in the country. When Olivia Barney heard about this, she realized that many of those artists also had work in the collection of the Heard Museum. Barney is the collections coordinator at the Heard, and she reached out to Charles King to see if he'd be willing to donate some of his collection. The result is an exhibit Barney calls Art and Soul. Decorated shoes, alongside ceramic pots, paintings, sculptures, and photography, all by Native artists.
I wanted to show their visual language and like how you could see their styles go from the shoes also to the artwork. So even though they're different mediums, you can still see that they're very similar in how they look. You can see certain designs that are repeated, or maybe the way they move their brush stroke is the same. So you can still tell it's the same artist.
One of the first installations shows a pair of Chucks featuring a painting of a tiger by Tammy Garcia. The shoes are displayed next to a ceramic pot, which Garcia also made. The pot is about a foot and a half tall, with a series of deep cuts and grooves in its body.
I just felt like the movement visually that was going on in the pot with her designs went very well with like the thick black bold lines of the tiger and how they varied in size. So it's very much just like how the deep carvings kind of match the brush strokes in the shoes.
Elsewhere in the exhibition, there's an oil painting by Philip L.P. Vigil from 2016, and it rhymes perfectly with a pair of shoes he painted several years later. Both works are densely packed with vibrant bursts of yellow, pink, and red.
I think it really showed the brushstrokes and like this, like the painting aspect of how he creates his work. Because while it's very detailed and it has very great shading, it's also showing like the splatters of paint. It's also not hiding the fact that it's a painting. So I really liked that it was like bold and out there.
On another wall, a portrait by Marla Allison shows a woman in profile. Her hair is decorated with a series of dark black triangles that gradually increase in size. Next to the portrait, a similar set of triangles appears on the sides of the shoes she painted. As I looked at these various pairings, I was struck by the subtle but clear connections between them. There were obvious echoes of shape and color and style, which, Barney told me, is exactly what she was hoping the exhibit would make me think about. Art and Soul is a show about the choices artists make, whether it's on a canvas or a sneaker. But it occurred to me that I might not have noticed those choices if I wasn't seeing them in an unfamiliar place, like the heel of a pair of Chucks. That, Barney told me, is also intentional. The shoes are an invitation to viewers who might not think of themselves as connoisseurs of fine art.
To show kind of just something they could connect to, which is the sneakers, and that makes all the other creations much more approachable.
But there was also something bigger going on.
It's showing them something they see in their everyday lives, but then connecting them to Native cultures, these people who are artists and also happen to be Native too. So it's also just a way to make the art institution more approachable too.
Barney told me there's this conversation they have at the Herd sometimes about what audiences expect when they come to the museum. There can be this perception that Native artwork is quote-unquote traditional, that it's somehow anachronistic, a vestige of a culture that doesn't exist anymore. Barney says part of her goal is to reject that idea. A lot of the work on display at the Herd emanates from Native cultures and traditions, but that doesn't mean it's not contemporary art.
When traditional art was created, it was contemporary. And I think we try to take that forward in a lot of our exhibits, is that there's not a delineation between the two. It's like they both feed each other. It's always back and forth, like that we're always creating something new. And I think it's good to show that and not pigeonhole artists into just one specific style or one specific thing, which is also, I think, why we wanted to show these shoes with the artwork. So showing the expansiveness and innovation of artists.
On the rear wall of the exhibition, Barney showed me a set of works by Jason Garcia. Garcia likes drawing in a style inspired by comic books. On his Chucks, he created a superhero version of a member of his tribe. In the accompanying piece, a clay tile with an illustration, he drew a pair of corn maidens in tribal regalia. They're holding smartphones and cameras, and there's a TV satellite in the background.
It's showing Native people, like just how we are today. It's showing we do have traditional aspects in our culture, but we also, you know, use technology. We're also tied into the current day and everybody else too. Like what everybody else does as people, we do too.
Olivia Barney is the collections coordinator at the Herd Museum, where Art and Soul is on display through January 5th. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
Since the 1970s, cities have been employing something called hostile architecture to try to keep certain people from being in certain places. Think handles on bus benches to prevent people from laying down on them. Some states are now starting to rethink this, but our next guest says it's still very common in cities around the world. Jonathan Pacheco Bell is a senior embedded planner at the firm Four Leaf Inc. and a lecturer in urban and regional planning at Cal Poly Pomona. Last year, he spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, and they started with how he defines hostile architecture.
Well, I define hostile architecture as elements of the built environment designed to deter normal human behaviors, like sitting or resting, and make publicly accessible spaces uncomfortable for targeted populations. If you've been out in a city anytime recently, you have encountered hostile architecture. When you see that bus bench with the extra crossbars attached to it, that is deliberately made to be uncomfortable so a homeless person can't lay there and rest. That is a highly visible example of hostile architecture.
They don't necessarily have to be super obvious, though, right? Like, they can be things that people might mistake for architectural details or design details, right?
That is correct. A lot of hostile architecture is obvious. It's ostentatious because it wants to drive you away. But a lot of it is also subtle. One of the more subtle versions of it are those metal attachments grafted onto handrails or ledges that sometimes look like design elements, but they're usually a way to push away people from sitting there, and especially to push away skateboarders from using those ledges or those handrails to do their tricks.
Does it tend to have the desired effect of, you know, keeping people experiencing homelessness from laying on benches or keeping skateboarders from using handrails for their tricks?
It has the effect of displacing people. It has the effect of pushing people away. Hostile architecture does not offer any solutions. So when we have things like metal attachments grafted onto ledges, or spikes, sometimes the much more aggressive versions, or those crossbars on bus benches, or when you have things like exterior sprinklers that rain down water on the sidewalk to prevent people from standing there, or when you have things like obvious obstructions placed on the sidewalk so as to prevent people from sleeping, none of that amounts to a solution. It just pushes the problem elsewhere.
Does it also cause people who otherwise are trying to use those things, like other bus riders, for example, like, does it make things a little less comfortable or less user-friendly for people maybe who are not the targeted population that this kind of stuff is aimed at?
Absolutely. And I'm really glad you brought that up. See, hostile architecture is designed to target vulnerable populations, unhoused people, folks deemed loiterers, right? Teenagers often are the target of hostile architecture, but it has effects on anybody who is in public space. So we all are impacted by hostile architecture.
What are the conversations like about this among your colleagues and other people who do what you do? Because somebody's got to decide, yes, we're going to put these in, or no, we're not. So for cities or for city planners or, you know, others in a city who decide, yes, we need these, we want these, they have to have their reasons to do it. So, like, what are those conversations like?
A lot of times city planners get blamed for this, but in fact, it's oftentimes not city planners that are deciding to add hostile architecture. Rather, it's the absence of mechanisms within city planning to deal with it, one of my longstanding critiques. So yes, there are instances where public agencies or the state might support the addition of hostile architecture, but there are also many instances where the private sector is doing this. You have sometimes groups that form together to create hostile architecture to add in public space to drive away those who they've deemed undesirable. And then sometimes you have sort of lone wolf individuals, right? So this is a multidimensional issue. This is a multidimensional public space equity issue with a lot of people involved in it. My critique is that the urban planning field has done very little to address it. The sharpest critiques that are coming out right now about hostile architecture are coming from the citizen journalists, young people on TikTok. And that is giving me hope that we're going to have a turning point where we can start really talking about this as an international public space equity issue driven by young people on social media.
Yeah, that is interesting. I wonder if you draw a distinction between maybe public places, you know, city parks, bus benches, things like that, and, you know, private spaces, you know, in the space in front of a business or maybe even in front of an apartment building or somebody's home, where somebody, you know, who owns that space, not the city, has put something there to maybe dissuade people experiencing homelessness from camping out there, or skateboarders or whomever else. Do you see a difference between cities using these and private individuals or private businesses using these?
Well, this is a really good question, because it's talking about what we have access to, right? That's the heart of your question. The front of a building might be privately owned. And that's why I talk about hostile architecture as being a problem in publicly accessible spaces, meaning, yes, the public right-of-way, the sidewalk, but also those areas that might be publicly accessible and technically on private property, right? We have sometimes areas of cities that look like a sidewalk, but they're actually privately owned. Mm-hmm. There might be an easement there, or it might be that the property line extends there, but it's privately owned, yet it's still publicly accessible. So the criticism stands, I believe, because even if it's a privately owned space, if it's publicly accessible, it's creating an inequity for people in public if they can't use it by sitting down, because there are spikes coming out of it, for example, or obvious obstructions. And the heart of the problem of hostile architecture is this: publicly accessible space, the built environment, is for all of us. We all have a right to access and be in public space. This design approach drives us away, and it makes the right to the city impossible.
Do you see it as maybe a little better? You mentioned that, you know, it's not a solution, it just pushes people away. Are these more acceptable if there is also a solution? For example, if a city has, you know, accessible shelters or a place for people who would like to camp outdoors to go to say, okay, we don't want you in this park, we don't want you on this bus bench, but here are, you know, some places that you can go instead. Like, does that make it any better?
We certainly need those resources for our unhoused neighbors. We need those resources for anybody from the community who is in need. But the presence of hostile architecture is still a problem. I'm envisioning a city without the deliberate design of inequity. As an urban planner, that's the kind of community, that's the kind of city I want for our people. If hostile architecture exists, it makes public space inequitable. It makes people uncomfortable. So the presence of it alone is a problem.
All right, Jonathan, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Jonathan Pacheco Bell is a senior embedded planner at the firm Four Leaf Inc. and a lecturer in urban and regional planning at Cal Poly Pomona.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.